This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program for the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Now in standard orbit, sir.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp.
And I am Nick Anastasio.
And I am Amy Nelson.
Yeah, so welcome back, guys. I've got some good news. Zach will be back next week. Finally, he's coming back. So it's good, and we're very happy to have him. He's doing well. In fact, today as we're recording this, his Astros beat the snot out of my Red Sox. So I don't know if I'm going to let him back, to be honest with you. We'll have to see how that goes. But anyway, once again, I've got Nick, three shows in a row with Nick, and two out of three with Amy. Thank you so much for coming aboard and helping Standard Orbit out as we continue to drive further and faster.
That's what it takes to fill in for Zach.
Oh, don't stroke his ego. No, we won't go there. So, Nick, it's Nick. Nick came up with an idea a few weeks ago, and we've been trying to kind of, all right, how are we going to launch this thing? As you know, if anybody's on Facebook or the Babel Conference and sees Nick's replies or whatever, you always get this ape looking at you with his avatar. It's actually the first time I saw it. I remember it scared me a little bit because, well, all right, I'm a wuss. Anyway, and it's very
the idea, Ken.
Yeah, it's very intimidating. And so Nick is a big Planet of the Apes fan. And he put together, I thought, a pretty cool concept, right? We know that there was this comic book thing they did not that long ago and kind of put the two universes together. I didn't think it was really done very well. But the concept Nick came up with was very interesting. So, Nick, I'll let you tell our listeners your idea and what we're going to be talking about today.
Well, I was rewatching Planet of the Apes, the original, a while back. And all of a sudden, I don't know why, because I've seen this movie many times. I'm a big fan, as you said. And all of a sudden, I started to, I think it was probably the look of it, and we can talk about that at some point, is in the early part when they're still in the desert. And I just went from that to, oh, this kind of, it's funny. It looks a little bit like Vasquez Rocks. It looks a little bit like when TOS was on location half the time. Hmm. And from there, I started to think, you know, actually, Planet of the Apes is not unlike a big episode of Star Trek. And a lot of people have said that Planet of the Apes was like Twilight Zone the movie for very good reason. And I think that that's right. I mean, it's obviously a Rod Serling script. And it feels very much, if you know, and like the Twilight Zone, like a long episode of the Twilight Zone in some ways. And we can talk about that as well a little bit, comparisons between Roddenberry and Rod Serling that way. But I did all of a sudden start to see a lot of parallels in the themes, in the plot, in some of the lead characters. I started to think about Taylor, the character played by Charlton Heston, and Kirk. And while they're not exactly the same characters, but there's definitely some similarities. Part of it is also the time period and how leading men were perceived and played their roles in entertainment. And then I was thinking, oh, and geez, this movie was contemporary to TOS. It came out, it was made and came out when TOS was on the air. So all of this kind of meshed into, I thought, wouldn't it be great if we did, it's a combination of things that have been done on the network before, but that's also a little different. Something which is a comparison, looking at a movie that was contemporary to TOS, and talk about that comparison, and also do, it's not really a rewrite, but kind of see how the story, obviously all we have is our imagination, would play out if we dropped our favorite TOS characters in it. And so that's where it's different from the crossover that they did in the comic books. My idea wasn't so much to come up with a new story, but to say, okay, let's try to start with the script that got executed for Planet of the Apes, and let's go from there. If we had to use that story and make it into a TOS episode, what would happen? So that's kind of what I came up with, and I thought that we could divide the show, the episode into a few sections, and we can maybe start by talking about, we don't have to go in detail into the film because it's not a Planet of the Apes podcast, but we can talk a little bit about our first reactions when we first saw that film, context, when it was, and Amy, I think you saw it for the first time recently, so it'll be interesting actually to see a fresh perspective on an old movie, you know, watching that movie for the first time today, what that feels like. And then we can talk a little bit about the ways, generally speaking, not in terms of plot so much, but themes, like I said, the creatives, Roddenberry and Sterling, the ways in which we feel like it is like TOS, the parallels, the way that we feel like in those parallels, there's also divergence and differences. And then we can finish with doing kind of our little imaginative rewrites of what would happen if it was Kirk instead of Taylor. So that was the idea.
Well, it's a very clever idea, you know, and you threw me though, because all my notes and everything came from, you said old movie. I was like, what are you talking about? Wahlberg didn't make that movie that long ago, right? I mean,
right. The definitive Planet of the Apes. The definitive.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, God, that was awful. Anyway, what do they say? Abraham Lincoln? Is that what they say
in that movie? Yeah. If this podcast had been around April 1st, I would have said, let's just play a joke on these guys and totally, as long as possible, with a straight face, make it like we're going to talk about the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's not, so we're not even going to pretend.
No, that was a red alert wave off. Do not watch that film. I remember that distinctly. Yeah. Yes. That
I will say, for the sake of being positive, it has amazing, amazing costumes. The ape suits are beautiful. I thought they were great. And that's where my positive review is going to stop.
Okay, and that's where it is. So, Amy, since you saw it the most recent, right? You just saw it the other day. What were your first impressions of the movie?
Yeah, so I went online to try and find it, and oh my goodness, there's, I don't know what, 20 Planet of the Apes? No, I don't know. There was at least 5 or 6. And so I'm texting you guys. I'm like, I don't know which one you're talking about. And I opened up my brother's DVD things, and there was Planet of the Apes. So I popped it in, and apparently it was the Tim Burton one that you guys are saying, and you're like, don't watch it. I'm like, too late. It's already on. So I did happen to see that one, but then I, you corrected me, and I went and saw the 1968 one, and I told my mom, I was like, hey, I'm watching this. She's like, oh, it's such a good movie. And so I know my mom likes it. I really enjoyed it. I've watched it twice. Well, 1.5 times, I guess. But, I thought the idea was very interesting. And in watching it, like, there are so many quotable lines in there that I'm like, oh, is that where that comes from? Like, because I didn't know. I'd never seen it before. So I was pretty impressed that it really is in our culture, like that movie. And I know I'd seen that ending with the Statue of Liberty, And now I know the movie that it goes with. So I was sort of surprised that I had recognized so many different parts from the movie and not even knowing that it was that movie.
No, oh, that's cool. That's cool. I don't know how many times. I was a big Planet of the Apes fan growing up, and it was on all the time. There was a TV show that made me so terrified when I was a kid. The opening of that show, the whole thing, the music, the everything. It just I remember just being scared out of my mind, more so than the movies. The opening of the TV show was much more terrifying to me. I don't know why, but it was really, really, I don't know, little eyes, I guess. But you know, it was funny when you were saying, Nick, about, you know, it was in the same era, same way that men were kind of portrayed in the 60s, you know, that leading manish. And the first thing I thought about is like, yeah, Charlton Heston didn't have a shirt on most of the time either, did he?
No, so, he did not.
Oh, and Amy intercepts. Good for you, Amy. So you remembered that part. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, you look like you're perspiring a little bit.
Ooh, it's getting warm in here.
Yeah. He was, Charlton Heston was the man back then. But as far as movies go, yeah, I mean, I know the word iconic is overused now because it's such a common thing, but that movie was. And they always say, you know, that some of the best forms of flattery is parody. So you've seen, you know, that mock Statue of Liberty scene, and you saw it in Spaceballs. It was in, an animated movie. I forget now. I just remember Ben Stiller was one of the voices of Madagascar. That's what it was. You'll see that scene come up a few different times, but a very powerful one. And because I've seen it so many times, I was trying to remember my first reaction to the Statue of Liberty. And it was so beautifully filmed, that ending, you know, where you come behind the statue and whatever. He's like, what is he looking at? And then when it becomes apparent, it really throws you that they're on Earth. So, yeah, I mean, it's a great movie. I think I see a lot of the parallels. I don't think I saw it until Nick explained it. It's always nice when you have somebody who's really passionate about something who describes something like that. And then you say, yeah, I can see the parallels. And the more you talked about it, Nick, I was like, yeah, you know, you could make this work in a couple of different ways with Star Trek. I'm not going to go into that now, but I'm sure as we discuss, we'll be able to pull that out. But, yeah, my first impressions of the movie was it was just awesome. And I know Brandon is a huge Planet of the Apes fan. So there's a lot of them out there. And so is Zach, actually. So if he wasn't at the game watching his team beat my Red Sox, he probably would have joined us tonight. But
what do you think? Zach is the one who actually started my nickname, Ape Face.
Yes, he did.
It's a Zach trademark.
Yes, it is a Zach trademark. That's right. That was right. That was a shout out episode when we were thanking everybody. That's right. And I remember him going, we were trying to pronounce your last name, and he just went, what do you mean, Ape Face?
Yeah.
That was different. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's funny. I had a very similar experience to yours. Well, it was with the film, not with the series. I saw the series, but a little later. I was a little older. But when I was growing up in France, the film played every summer on TV. Mm-hmm. There were a few. I mean, it was maybe 6 or 7 years after the movie had come out. France at the time, what they would do is they would buy these, well, they weren't really old movies yet, but movies that had come out a few years before, and those would be staples. It's what they had, and we only had 3 channels at the time, not that different from here. And basically, every summer, you kind of had these movie festivals where they would play the same movies, you know. Usually it was on Sunday night movie. And I must have been 6 or 7 when I first saw it. And I was fascinated and scared, but not in a run and hide behind the couch kind of scared. I just, there's something about it, I don't know what, that felt so real to me. And I think that's kind of what scared me, but it's, I thought it was freaky in the way that the apes looked so real. But at the same time, I remember clearly the world that they live in, the landscape that the astronauts walk through until they get to the village, the look of the village itself looked so alien to me, and yet very realistic. And I think the portrayal that the actors put into the ape characters probably is what really struck that chord of feeling very real at the same time as they looked like they were completely inhuman characters. And I was fascinated by that as a kid. And every summer I would watch, I would look at the TV guide and see that it was next Sunday's Planet of the Apes. And I was just so excited. You know, it was a big movie night. I would just, I had my little like seat on the floor in the living room and I would take my snacks after dinner and I would just, my eyes would go big. And I was, it was always that same mix of being kind of scared because I felt like it was so real. And I think probably the music by Jerry Goldsmith, which is very experimental and has all these sort of strange sound effects, probably contributed to kind of making it creepy, but also really fascinating to me. That was kind of the context for that, which is funny because, and again, I've never thought about that until a few weeks ago when the idea came to my mind. It's around the same time, probably a year or two before, that my dad started to show me TOS and that I started to love Star Trek. So that's my context and my first experience with the film.
That's pretty interesting. So it had nothing to do with the fact that the person who wrote the original novel was from France as well, or is a Frenchman?
No, I didn't. No connectivity for that? No. Until much later. Yeah. I think it wasn't until much later. I think I was a teenager when I found out that it was based on a novel and that it was a French author. Yeah. And read it. And honestly, I have to say, a national pride aside, it's an interesting novel. But it's, in my opinion, far inferior to the film. And you can really see, and this is something that Rod Serling did a lot of. Rod Serling actually, he was a genius writer, but part of his genius wasn't just coming up with great stories. He often, during his work on The Twilight Zone, he often worked with material that had been written in some form, short stories a lot, or novellas. And he would see a nugget in there that was there. It's really the diamond in the rough. And he had this really amazing talent at understanding how the story, how that nugget could be 10 times better or more powerful if it was told in a different way. And if you compare the novel to what he did in the film, it's far, far superior to the novel. The novel is interesting. It's very interesting, especially as a comparison. Mm-hmm. But it's not that good of a book, yeah. In my opinion.
Yeah, it's like Jaws. Jaws mm-hmm. was just an okay novel, but a great movie. So
yeah.
Okay. All right, Amy. Time to get you back in the game. So you've seen the movie. You liked it. I thought one of the things that was fascinating too was the makeup at that time. How wonderful it was, and how Roddy McDowall can make that ape seem so alive with the expressions. Kim Reed was pretty good too, but he just had a way about him. As you were watching it and you started to kind of go down where Nick was sending us to the parallels in Star Trek, did you see any right away, or what were the things that made you say, yeah, I see it, or is it still something you're kind of clawing for?
Well, I think the themes of the movie of Planet of the Apes definitely deal a lot with the social issues. And so in that, it's very similar to, you know, the original series and Star Trek in general. But I wanted to sort of talk about, okay, so when I watched Planet of the Apes, to me, it was so real and authentic, and I was there, and there was no CGI. It was such a breath of fresh air. And I was like, oh my gosh, this movie is fabulous. I was just enjoying the scenery and the action. And I'm wondering, like, okay, this is a contemporary of TOS. And when I watch TOS, and I'm sorry, I don't ever feel that way. And I'm wondering if it's because, like, when TOS, they do their... I don't know, the technology or something that sort of throws me out of it. And I was like, oh, that's so stupid. Or mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be, you know, disrespectful.
No, it's okay.
Of the original series, but
it's a really good point. I mean, I think that some of it, and I'm speculating at this point, but I think I would say a half educated speculation, based on what was going on in both mediums, is probably what drives the things, the differences you picked up in that. I mean, and this we talked about this section of our episode being about the parallels and the differences in those parallels. So I think that this is smack dab in the middle of the era where cinema was experimental, and really you're breaking, this is the time when the studios, their hold on how films are made that lasted through the 30s and 40s and 50s is breaking. You know, and for 3-4 decades, you had this very regimented, studios had specific types of actors, studios specialized on specific genres of films. And then all of that in the mid to late 60s starts to fall apart. And with that, there's an influx of creative experimentation on every level. If you look at the score for Planet of the Apes, it's a very good, I think, example of what probably applies to a degree with the whole film. It's a score that's completely unlike anything in traditional Hollywood. It's, you have composers that are starting to basically apply the idea that, well, we can use sound effects or just sounds and have that be part of the score. And if you look at TOS in contrast, in that sense, at that point, we're still very much in the, I think the paradigm where TV is kind of like the ugly little brother, like TV basically is kind of deemed sort of an inferior version of form of entertainment. And TV kind of tries to do things like the movies. And so in that sense, TV is going to be a little further behind. And so if you have movies that are already experimenting and that are kind of maturing into a different form, you have TV probably modeling its production in the way that movies were made 5 or 10 years before. So I think that you're going to have kind of studio network TV produced in a way that's much more maybe campy, even by that time, you know, whereas cinema is already trying to graduate and mature towards something that's a lot more realistic, grounded, and bare, kind of where it projects you into the reality, as opposed to accentuating that it's a different reality you're looking at. If you look at 2001, Space Odyssey came out the same year as Planet of the Apes, and you know it's about as opposite to Star Trek in terms of the approach of science fiction. No sound in space, no music, everything is very, very almost like a documentary. So I think this is probably what you're picking up on.
Well, thus endeth the lesson. That was pretty cool.
Edit me down, Ken.
Oh, no. It's all good stuff. And I was very, very invested in what you were saying. For me, when you talk about the parallels, I think a lot of it has to do with the leading man type stuff, pieces of it. And, you know, kind of that, Charlton Heston is definitely the hero in this movie. We just don't know what he's up against. There's a lot of, I think, good lessons that are learned. You know, there was a lot of philosophical beliefs amongst the apes that kind of paralleled the human beliefs in Star Trek, right? Mm-hmm. They had a pretty rigid set of laws about not harming one another and things along those lines, which I thought was kind of interesting. But you know, and I think you had hit it before, a lot of the scenery, even though the sets on Star Trek were pretty weak at times, when they did go on location, it seemed to be out in the desert, you know, in mm-hmm. that type of environment quite a bit. So I thought it hit pretty well there. And just the timeline. I mean, we were dealing with outer space. We were dealing with, I thought, some pretty dang good special effects for that era. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. And I think there's the one of the things that parallels. I remember when Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, was coming out, that they were very close, or it was the largest makeup movie since the last Planet of the Apes movie was made. So in all that time, I don't know when the last one was done, let's say, what, 74, 75, something like that?
That sounds about right, 74, like I think. Yeah. Yeah,
so you go almost 17 years till another movie had anything even close, right? So it was just putting all the makeup on the Klingons in that movie came close. I don't remember if it beat it. I don't think it did, but I think it was the largest makeup, the amount of mass and prosthetics and things and all that. So there's kind of an interesting parallel with that, because since then I'm sure everything has been pretty much CGI, right? Since I'm quite sure that's what they did with Avatar, right? So yeah it's pretty cool on those fronts, but that's how I saw it. That's, you know, there was a same general feeling. It is funny when you watch a movie that's made in a certain era, even if they're making a movie about a historical event or something along those lines, you can still look at it and go, oh, that was made in the 60s, or that was made in the 70s. You know, just by the hair. For whatever reason, people never really adjusted haircuts or looks or anything like that to change with the time. And Planet of the Apes, obviously, I mean, these are just astronauts that were stuck in space a long time. And so they grew beards, which really wasn't commensurate with the amount of time they were asleep, but that's okay. It was still pretty cool, I thought.
Yeah, no, and I think you talked about the obviously themes and the philosophical ideas, and I think that, and Amy mentioned that as well, there's definitely a lot of parallels there from the time period. I mean, this is as well, you know, the late 60s, civil rights, the flower generation, a lot of things are coming in question, and you see that obviously. I think that is also kind of what creates this parallel, the similarity between the two. Exploring, there's a what if, but also using it's a Star Trek trope. It's a science fiction trope when science fiction is done well. Using something else, something that's non-human, as a way to actually put a mirror up to humanity, and basically in this story. The apes are actually us, and it's a way for Rod Serling to be able to make a commentary on humanity, and have that pill be digested more easily because they have monkey masks, and I think that in that sense there is also a parallel. That's something that I wanted to touch on a little bit, that comes through the two creatives, through Serling and Roddenberry. And it's really fascinating to me. You know, I learned a little bit about Serling's background. To me, it's not a coincidence that these are two men who served in World War II and were in combat in World War II, saw action, and both came out of the war changed men, and both creative people with imagination, and both saw an opportunity in the realm of science fiction consciously. That was the conscious choice on their part, to be able to exercise some of their demons, but really also try to talk about some of the lessons which they felt they had learned internally about going through the war. Saw, I think, where it's interesting, and there's both a parallel and a difference. There's a measure of hope, I think, in Serling, or at least a warning. But I think you see a truer measure of optimism and hope in Roddenberry, and from what he's seen, kind of the belief that surely the worst is past and it's going to get better, and this is how we can get better. Whereas Serling, and I think, you know, he was fairly known for being pretty bitter or jaded, disappointed with mankind, and I think it only got worse as his life wore on. But you see him, and you do see that, I think there's, if there's differences in Taylor compared to Kirk and the outcome of the stories, you do see, I think, a lot more sort of, not as much optimism, not as much faith that things can turn out for the best, in the long run between the two.
Yeah, I would agree with that one, especially with the ending of that movie. It kind of says it all, right? And the frustration of not being smart enough. So you could take it one way. It's like it's a warning, either shape up or this is what's going to happen, or
right,
we're destined, and it's, and that, and that is what's going to happen. So
right.
I hear you. Okay. Good stuff. Very good stuff. So you put together a little exercise for us, Nick.
Yeah, so I thought we could talking about the differences and the parallels that could lead us to doing sort of a rewrite, and basically say, okay, well, if we say that we start with this story, but instead of Taylor, it's Kirk. Mm-hmm. Let's start from there. Where do we go? What if it's going to be an episode of TOS, what parts are going to be the same? What parts are going to change? Who are we going to have on the planet? Is it Earth? Is it an alternate Earth? Or is it an alien planet? I thought it would be fun to have a little bit of conversation about that, kind of rewriting it as a TOS episode.
How creative is our teacher guest star tonight?
Because
I know math teachers are very creative.
Oh, very logical.
I know, I'm kidding. That way.
So as I was thinking about it, I was like, okay, obviously, yes, we have Kirk as the main character. And unfortunately, Planet of the Apes, like the two other astronauts, like they are not in the movie. And I'm like, oh, well, that's pretty sad because you want to see the trio, right? Kirk, Spock, and Bones. And so we've got to work them into it. So let's say they don't die, but, you know, they do get captured and then treated this way. And so I'd like to see all three of them in there. I imagined it being a different planet, not the Earth. So they're out in their travels, and then they get captured, and, you know, and just sort of follow from there. So I'm gonna say it's on a different planet, and we have all three of them there.
Yeah, I you're right. Because we start with the three astronauts, I immediately thought, okay, well, the first thing that would happen is that would be the trio, and obviously Spock and Bones aren't gonna die. So, yes. So then we go from there, and I could totally see them walking around the planet for a little bit. I think it would be fun. I can, you know, Cornelius and Zero are scientists, and they're both doctors, and Bones is a doctor, and I could totally see some banter there if somehow he gets captured first. And in a way, even though it steals some of Kirk's thunder, I see some really fun moments. If he was the one who Zira first discovers and who first talks to her, doctor to doctor, basically, you know, and her thinking that she's this intelligent ape who's clearly smarter than a human. And then, you know, I could see some of Bones' Southern charm come out, you know, giving her some crap about how I'll show you real medicine. I don't know. I think that you'd want to have Kirk get captured. And then I thought maybe Spock would be the one who actually evades capture. Maybe Bones gets captured first, and then Kirk and Spock are ambushed, but Spock is able to escape. And you could have kind of a B plot where he's the one trying to find a way then, because that's kind of Spock's character, smart one of the group. And then he's trying to find a way to track down where the Ape City is and free Kirk and Bones.
Well, yeah, because you could have him go against the war general ape guy, you know, and sort of evading him and trying to rescue them, but, you know, so playing that military game there.
Yeah, you know, there would definitely be some of that. I could also see, I mean, at some point there's got to be a face-off between Kirk and General Ursus, because that's basically, I mean, you want, right, that's almost like Kirk and the Gorn. you see that. I can visualize Kirk pulling his double fisted chop on one of the gorillas' neck, and also the scene, the trial of Taylor. You know that there's got to be, if Kirk is there, if we've had the moment where Bones basically if he's the one who shows that men and humans can speak, and we don't have to have kind of this slow reveal with Taylor and his throat injury and all that, you know that there would be that Kirk would try to pull some Kirk Wordfoo on the Council of Apes during his trial and reverse the situation and show them how they're the ones who are barbarians, or they're the ones who are being prejudiced against him, which could still end with them kind of pulling the whole, you know, hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil, that they do in the film.
Huh. So I went in a very different direction. Yeah.
Good.
Well, good. I went, I don't know, maybe it's somber stuff. I don't know why. But, you know, the Planet of the Apes movie is powerful. It's just a very powerful movie. And I think, to me, it was like, I didn't want to lose that message. So I think a lot about TNG. You might have heard of that. It stands for The Next Generation. It was a show that came on after TOS. And it was on for like 7 years or something.
Oh, this is why I'm on the show.
Yeah, it was on for like 7 years, something like that. So anyway, there was a you know, an episode who was involved, like this deity type guy, and the humans were really being smug and arrogant, and he was going to show them, you know what, you better get used to the fact that space is full of danger, and even though you're out here in a big hotel with little kids, you can get your nose bloody pretty bad. And that's exactly what happens, right? And the crew on that ship learn a pretty important lesson, and also they understand that they need to shape up, and they realize that these very bad people, these Swedish type people with really bad skin, are coming for Earth, right? So I was thinking along those terms, where there were many times where Kirk, Spock, and McCoy and the crew or whatever are they're either caught like Spectre of the Gun or Savage Curtin. Or, you know, an alien puts them in a situation where they either have to prove their humanity, or, you know, even Arena is sort of like that, right? But in this case, I thought we could go one or two ways. You have an alien that is showing them that, you know, humans aren't perfect. Bad things can still happen, even on Earth, if things aren't switched around, because we are talking about 60s Trek, not 80s and 90s track, or it's an alternate universe that they find themselves in, and essentially that same plot. Because I can't think of anything more powerful than Kirk and watching Spock and McCoy get killed or get operated on, or any of those same scenarios where, like, man, it would be dramatic as heck. And you know, it might have that Voyager flavor restart at the end.
The
reset button might have to be pushed. But man, it would be very powerful. And I could see it working, because it's that same message. Maybe it's not Earth. Maybe it's another planet that's going through it. Or like I said, maybe it's another, like I hate multiverse things. Like, it drives me crazy. But it would be an effective way to tell a story. And it could so easily work, because Taylor and Kirk are the same person in many, many ways. Passionate, angry, intelligent, but yet will you know, they're not always going to talk. Kirk's great at talking himself out of things, but he'll throw a punch, you know, before you know, you know, he'll come out of left field with that sidewinder and come after you. So that's where I was coming from. I was coming from a very darker place. And watching all these events take off that way, it would just have to have something on the front end that puts them in that situation. You know, they beam down in a storm or something, and boom, they're someplace else that they didn't expect to be. And it's a parallel Earth in the same time frame, and all these things happen. Somehow there's a reset, or it's an alien that's trying to teach them a lesson.
It's funny. No, that's awesome. I mean, I wasn't as bold as you, because I didn't dare go in a place where I was thinking, okay, well, we could have, like you said, the Voyager formula of, if we set it up properly, we can go and kill Spock or kill Bones and lobotomize, you know, Spock, or vice versa, and then reset the button at the end. But I did, when I was thinking about the setup initially, I was thinking exactly in terms of, it would be really cool if you were talking about a storm or something. There's obviously a Star Trek trope of a phenomenon. Something happens at the beginning, right, and they crash on this planet. And what I thought would be cool is if they don't know whether they are on an alien planet or whether this is Earth. Because remember, Planet of the Apes is supposed to take place, I think it's 4,000 years and change from our present.
Right.
Which would also be the far future for the TOS era. Mm-hmm. And so if they don't know where they are exactly, if they've traveled in space or in time or both, and you could have, if you were willing to sacrifice the twist of the reveal of the Earth at the end and the Statue of Liberty, mm-hmm, and move that earlier in the film, and you have it either right off the bat or maybe half an hour or so in the movie, maybe it is when Kirk is on trial and the apes tell him that he's on Earth. If Kirk gets to find out that this is Earth in the future, and somehow the dream of the Federation, mm-hmm, collapsed, and again, he still doesn't know, is it an alternate future? Did they travel in a parallel universe, or is this their Earth? But even in the doubt of that it might be their future, you could actually end up having a Kirk who is even more in line with Taylor, because you could have him, and you talked about these parallels, you know, the passion and the anger that he can have. If he is convinced, even if at the end we decide that they're going to be, that it's not there, it's not the Prime Earth, but if for a while Kirk thinks that, well, the Federation failed,
yeah,
you could see him go in a dark place where he would, it would generate some of that same maybe bitterness that Taylor has in the film about humanity not being able to sustain itself at the level that it rose during the time of the Federation.
Yeah. Well, I guess the question was really, listen, you came up with, I think, a very good scenario, a very good plot line, an approach that would be a fine show, and it just changed it up. It made it more like a Star Trek episode. I took a Star Trek episode and made it more like Planet of the Apes. That's all. And it was just a different way to show it. But in you know, just like City on the Edge of Forever, you want that powerful ending that grabs you and shakes you. And I think usually in TOS and TNG and all the shows, it always comes off with, there's a scary message here, but you feel pretty good. You feel pretty optimistic. They would all, I like the idea where Nick is saying, you know what? Something goes wrong. The Federation falls apart. And 4,000 years in the future, this is the way it's going to be. What would they be looking for? What would be the signs that, you know, because it would just be an eye blink when you're talking about their lifespans in 4,000 mm-hmm. years. You know, what could be the trigger to see this thing end and all these things change on Earth, right? And that's where I think it could really be fascinating. You know,
yeah, and if you think... Go ahead. No, sorry. Go ahead again.
I was just saying, I wouldn't even have to need the Statue of Liberty. It could be the Golden Gate Bridge, which is such a big iconic thing in Star Trek, right? Or something along those lines. I don't know if everybody would catch it or if it would be as powerful. Because we don't see, you know, the only really piece of architecture we see consistently again over and over in Star Trek is either the Golden Gate Bridge or the Eiffel Tower. Really mm-hmm. don't see anything else. So one of those two things that could be more Star Trek-y, perhaps. But I think that it would be a powerful message. And, you know, for such a show that talks about optimism, I find this too in business, and I find this in life. When things are going well, people can get very complacent, and bad things can sneak up on you because you're not paying attention to things. And you saw that a little bit with with the Federation, and they wrote that, I thought, quite in, as much as I teased TNG, that was a great episode. And that whole premise was a wake up call, because they were just so full of themselves. You could see that. And this could have been TOS's message, although it could be like something that's like something that could further and further along as Star Trek goes on and try to figure out what was it that brought the Federation down. And so, yeah, it's a pretty dark message. It's not what we think of Star Trek, but man, from an entertainment, powerful, philosophical type thing, it could be really fascinating.
And you could totally see it today. I mean, you know, since we like to always nod at the Kelvin timeline, you know, the great thing that the Kelvin timeline did is they created a world, a playing ground where we can play with the elements of TOS, but when done well, see how we can mix modern sophisticated ideas into TOS. And this is not a dig or diss at the original TOS. It's just, you know, things progress. And yeah. as we live through, I mean, science fiction, like everything, is a reflection of our lives. And so as we gain experience in our lives as a collective species, we learn more. And so we're able to apply more to things like Star Trek. And you can totally see, if it's done well, you know, the idea being, I mean, you have dreamers like Roddenberry who say, well, what if we can get better? And that's a great first step. But the next one is to remember that the things that man does that we take for granted as immutable are not. And you can build something beautiful and tall, but it's not as immutable as the sun or as the sky. And the sun itself is not immutable. And so mm-hmm. the fact that once you have it, you have to remember that you need to maintain it if you want it to remain what it is. And so to start with something which tells you, even if it's a with a question mark, is it our future? Does that mean that we have had the Federation for 200-300 years and we think we've arrived, but we could just as easily regress and lose what we've gained? And mm-hmm. if so, what do we do to make sure that doesn't happen? And maybe, you know, to countermand the darkness of it, because we still haven't talked about that, it's figuring out how you end that story. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where maybe we have more of an uplifting ending, instead of just, you know, ending with Kirk on his knees like Taylor saying, you did it, you failed. You actually kind of have a lesson learned ending, which allows our characters to return to the Federation with the idea that, okay, well, this is what, now that we have this perspective, this is what we need to do to make sure that we don't get there, that we don't fail, that we maintain the dream of the Federation, what Starfleet stands for, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it opens up, I mean, now that I've been listening to you talk, and just now my brain is going, I'm like, so Star Trek is so in the future, and then that's that ideal of, okay, there's no more disease, there's no more, you know, money system, and, you know, no hunger and things that we deal with on a daily basis here right now. And so that's so in the future. So we're looking at it and it's like, okay, there's our goal. Like, that's what we want to go towards. And now you're throwing, well, all of that is now gone and demolished. And how did we lose it? So it's like, you know, levels or degrees, as my brain sees it, you know, like first degree, second degree, third degree. So now we're up here at this third degree where we don't have the Federation. And it's like, man, we didn't even get to the second degree of that place, you know, and now we have to worry about getting there and losing it. And I just find that very interesting, because you think we're going in a good direction of, you know, with however we're going to get there, because you would think, you know, not having a monetary system and, you know, getting rid of the common cold and, you know, some major diseases, that's a step in the right direction. But what if that's leading us to, Ken, where you're saying we would end up, Planet of the Apes?
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying, Amy, is, like all things, right? We've we've evolved in the last 10 or 15 years. I think there's a lot of perceptions today that things are going in the wrong direction. I would grant you a lot of it's more perception than reality, just because of the way things are so divided. But the reality is, I can walk down any major street and I see people of all races, of all ages, of all creeds getting along just fine. Right. Every day. I see it every single day. And so are we taking the small portions of things and letting it grow to a point where we're missing the forest for the trees? And I think we are to a degree. And I think when you were saying, you know, there's no monetary system and there's no disease and there's no, well, you know, there's a lot of debate in Star Trek on how we get better. They just kind of say it, right? And there isn't anything that you can point to that says, okay, you know, it was war-weary nations finally said enough's enough. And within 50 years, as they showed us on Enterprise, they did away with poverty, which I think was the first piece, right? And then some diseases, obviously there was still plenty because we were dealing with them episodically from time to time, right?
Yeah.
And the whole money thing seemed to ebb and flow. There was still some sort of economics because people were offered roles and jobs, and you do aspire to move up just like you would in a hierarchy on a starship. You seem to do that on Earth. And I think about Jean-Luc Picard going for that job on the Atlantis expedition, and he was going to head that thing. So that was a new role, a new job. So you do see pieces of that. So since we don't really know exactly how it all works, nobody's, you know, there's been some books, there's Trekonomics, things like that, but all we know is that we got there. It would be fun to explore, just like maybe with Genesis. Did they cheat a little bit? Did something go wrong? Did they use proto matter in the Matrix, right? And this, whatever it is that you know, allowed these things to happen, and maybe something, you know, because sometimes bad things need to happen for good things to happen, right? I'm not promoting that, by the way. I'm just saying from a societal point of view. So what if something happened to create the Earth of the future, but there was something underneath the surface, and if it's not figured out, we wind up at the Planet of the Apes, and that could be a fun journey to try to figure that out.
That's
where I was going. So it's, hey, you know, there's a lot of directions for this, and one thing I don't think we really enjoy too much is we don't want dark Star Trek. That's not why we like the show. You know, Deep Space Nine, I really enjoyed that show, but it could get really dark at times. We want to make sure at the end we avoid it. It would be interesting to go on that journey of realizing that something happened that will cause this unless it's fixed. And because what they have is so special, they're going to do everything they can to fix it. What that it is, I don't know, but I think that would be a fun storyline.
Yeah, I think you both are really touching the nerve of it. I mean, I think that plot device wise, what you need, if you're going to have that end that we talked about, which it ends on a uplifting note, a note of hope, which is consistent in line with Star Trek, you first need to identify, or part of the story needs to become, once they figure out this is Earth, not knowing maybe if it is their Earth or prime Earth, but maybe it doesn't matter, because maybe if this is, if the course of this Earth, whether it's theirs or not, is similar, identical enough, the idea is we have to figure out what went wrong. What did the Federation, what did Starfleet, what did humanity do wrong that caused the collapse? Did it happen? First of all, the Federation is not Earth, and that's a big difference between Planet of the Apes and Star Trek. It's many worlds. So is it something that happened maybe outside of Earth, which caused the collapse of the Federation, and then Earth isolated, drifted, into regressed, or is it something that happened on Earth that caused the collapse of the Federation? Because if the future of the Planet of the Apes comes about in Star Trek, it means that Earth has been on its own for many, many centuries. Right. And so we're talking not just about a failure of humanity on the local quote unquote level, but, you know, collapse of the entire Federation and then isolation. And I think that you then have to, it's funny because there's similarities between that and things like City on the Edge of Forever or the Bail Riots episodes in DS9. But the difference is, of course, that these build into their plot device that they go into the past and they figure out what they have. It's almost like the Voyage Home as well, but they have to change in the past to correct the future, their present, right? But here we reverse it, where these guys are in their future and they're seeing something that happened that went wrong. Mm-hmm. And if they learn, then it's almost like it becomes a two-parter. Then they have to go back and then you get to more of like the City on the Edge of the Forest. They have to go back and undo, you know, it's the Edith Keeler must die moment. They have to make sure that whatever made things go wrong and led to the Planet of the Apes doesn't happen. Unless you get into even more Star Trek kind of thing of there's something at that point in time in the far future, which is like a Guardian of Forever, which is still there, which is what has thrown everything out of sync, which they can fix, even though they're in the future, they can fix it there. Mm-hmm. And it will realign everything back, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot of directions this thing could go. And hopefully going down a dark path wasn't what you guys were thinking, but I don't know.
I like it.
It could be deep, you know, and we're all watching Discovery, and Discovery's pretty deep. You know what I mean? It's very deep.
Yeah.
I'm enjoying it and all that. But maybe it's because watching Planet of the Apes again, watching the first three episodes of Discovery, kind of watching what's going on in the world today, and it hasn't been a good week at all. That's just where my mind went. But more so as a warning. You know, the other piece of it, Nick, is it might not be a thing of trying to go back and fix it, but try to look for the clues as they progress, even from series to series. What are the things that could undermine it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Yeah, you know, you're right. It might be that they, if it's basically, let's say that kind of what they did, you know, with Next Generation, let's say that they, TOS is more successful, it goes on for another couple of seasons. By the end, the network decides, well, we want to make a movie. And so the movie ends up becoming sort of the swan song for TOS. Mm. And you can have a story which deals with finding out about this possible future, resolving that story in that time, and then Kirk, Bones, and Spock going back and saying, well, from now on, it's about us. It's like that line that Picard has with Worf, you know, vigilance, Mr. Worf. And so, right. You know, you can leave it open-ended like that, where it's literally, and that's, I guess some could look at it as dark. I don't think so, because again, this is more, it's mature hope, not childish hope. You know, and I think in the 60s, as beautiful and romantic as it was, part of what caused some of the problems that happened later is the fact that at times we had kind of childish hope instead of mature hope. And it's nice to wish upon a star, but you also have to be able to, you know, be an adult and say things don't just happen by wishing. And so that's the first step, dream. But then you come back and say, okay, well, now we know that we can't take it for granted. You know, vigilance, Mr. Spock, vigilance. And you leave it at that. And then you could even say, you know, you can imagine kind of this alternate Roddenberry timeline where when he comes back for like you said, the next series, you can pepper that throughout where you have sort of always this will it or won't it happen? Are they on the right path to correcting this or are they not? You know, and you have the whole Section 31, you have things like the Pegasus, you have in all the Star Trek incarnations. Mm-hmm. You can say, well, is this something that's going to lead us towards this dark future that Kirk and Spock and Bones had a glimpse of, or are we avoiding it? Which is Planet of the Apes itself did a little bit of that. You know, when they started to deal with time travel, actually, ironically, you know, and the concept of can we change fate? Can we prevent the apes and humans from going to war? And at the end of the series, they imply that they do, but then the last shot is the statue of the great ape. And the tear rolls down, which all of a sudden tells you, well, does that mean that what they've achieved is going to get undone and they're going to go back to what we first saw? So you could have a little bit of that same back and forth, wondering the concept of vigilance. We can never take it for granted what the Federation has accomplished. It'd be pretty cool.
I hear you guys talking, and in my mind, when you're talking about, well, if we need to change for the future, and this is one possible outcome, and what can we do now to change it? I'm in my mind, and you're talking, going to the back, you know, to the past. Can we change it in the past? Can we change it in the future? Like, you guys are describing all good things. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, there's
my TNG lens. You know?
Yeah, that's a good parallel. You're right. And you could see if you were making that TOS movie, the Planet of the Apes TOS movie, maybe that's how we fix part of the plot telling. Maybe you have Kirk in his present and Kirk in the Planet of the Apes future. And maybe it's about him at some point. You know, maybe he realized that in a way he's the Edith Keeler of that story. And there's something that he did for all the right reasons in his present, which is the initial trigger that's going to lead in the space of decades or a couple of hundred years into a complete collapse of the Federation. Why not?
I like the parallel you came up with, Amy. I think it could go in that direction. I've always found that All Good Things probably may be one of the best Star Trek movie episodes, whatever you want to call it, in history. I mean, it's that good. And it's unique. It seemed to me to be more of a scientific, you know, mystery as to the cause and effect. And you could pull it into that. I guess I'm thinking much more thematic and much more, it's going to go for a while, I guess, is what I'm saying. Is, you know, they get a glimpse of that future, and then piece by piece, they're going to unravel what created it. And, you know, it could be years and years of shows. It could be weeks and weeks of shows. It could be whatever. So that's what I had in my head, that type of thing, you know?
Yeah. And you could have the end of it be just the fact that initially they're trapped on this planet and they're surviving. Once they realize that it's a possible future for Earth, it's about finding the way back. Just because it could be something as simple as them saying, well, if this future is going to be averted, we have to find a way to return, because we're the ones now with that foreknowledge of what may happen, who can apply the concept of vigilance and try to make sure that it doesn't. And then you can have your typical ticking clock race against the time, finding, you know, whatever the device is that's going to allow them to return to their time before the apes get them. And then when they finally make it, then you can have your vigilance Mr. Spock moment where they kind of go, okay, well, now we've seen what might happen. We know better than to take it for granted. Now let's start to work extra hard to make sure that we stay who we want to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So this was quite a ride for me. I enjoyed this. I like the perspectives. I like the thought. When you get into those creative modes, it can be a lot of fun. Hopefully our listeners will find it to be as interesting and come up with some cool ideas. So before we move on, I'll just say any last words or final thoughts around this topic, Amy?
No, I found it an interesting exercise to compare and contrast the two, because they do have the similar themes in Planet of the Apes, like just flops everything that we know, which Star Trek tends to do quite a bit. You know, it's like, oh, now apes are in control and humans are the animals, and just sort of that whole flip flop, or, you know, and we see it so many times in Star Trek, and I'm more familiar with Next Gen, but, you know, where, okay, now we've got women in charge. Oh, now we've got, you know, a species that's one sex. Now we've got, you know, androgynous, or, you know, and they just sort of flip the script on it. And I think Planet of the Apes did it so well. And it was so interesting to see these social issues coming through, you know, with the class system and the classification of the apes and you have to work your way up, and just how that is speaking to us nowadays. And like you said before, like these types of scripts and movies and TV series are, we're looking at us, but it's an easier pill to swallow because it's them, you know? So I enjoy comparing these two, and I'm glad for the opportunity to see another great iconic movie.
You think they're listening? Well, Paramount needs all the help I can get. Nick, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what Amy said, and I think that, you know, final thoughts, I would say kudos and thank you to these two creatives, because that it shows, and I know these are things that have been thrown around before about both Rod Serling and Gene Roddenberry, but, and they were both human beings, both with huge flaws. So it's not about putting them on a pedestal, but still kudos and thanks to them for, creating something, creating a platform, in those worlds, these stories. And this is probably the biggest similarity that 51 years later for one and 49 years later for the other, is something that can generate so much thought, deep thought, reflection. And it shows, I think, applying this, because I always try to apply things to not just have them be rhetorical, whether it's dark optimism, whether it's fear, warnings, there's value. If an idea is reflected and motivated, we shouldn't put it down. We shouldn't criticize it. You talked about discovery, Ken. I think a lot of people who I read about seem almost not afraid, but they'll talk about the fact that it's dark, and they say, you know, I don't want it to be, why is it so dark? Why is it so this? And I'm the first, when In the Darkness came out, I mean, it's in the title. And I felt like I was the first one to jump on the bandwagon to criticize it. But that's because I felt like it was trying to use the quote unquote darkness as a gimmick to make the film more hip, to make the film more palatable to audiences today, whatever. I have nothing against darkness. And I think Star Trek, even TOS, didn't shy from darkness when it's motivated. And when I see something like Discovery, I feel like they are applying that thought. They're not just being dark for the sake of being dark. They're not just saying, oh, you know what? Sex and gore and swearing sells, so we'll just make Star Trek darker because that'll sell it better. I don't see that at all. I just see them exploring ideas. And that's what films like Planet of the Apes did. That's what TOS did. They weren't afraid to go places which were challenging at the time. And I think that that's the lesson that these two guys, these two creatives gave us, is do not be afraid to ask the questions and think about it. And if you're reflecting, if you're thinking, you're on the right path, whatever it is you're thinking about, even if it's dark, the first step to getting out of the tunnel into the light is to walk through the tunnel. So.
Okay. Right. So, as a Frenchman, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is Churchill. You know, when you find yourself in hell, keep going.
Exactly.
So I was trying to think of a good French quote along those lines, but I couldn't. I had to go with Churchill. Sorry, it's just across the channel. What's 20 miles?
Close enough, yeah.
Right, we can play with that. All right, no, I appreciate that. And I appreciate your creativity coming up with this subject tonight. It's very different, and I like that. I like when things get shooken up a little bit. We like to play. It seems when we get into some serious topics, Nick, you're usually involved in it, which is a good thing. And Amy, you know, I thought you brought a lot to the table too, because it's good to see through fresh eyes completely, because you're looking at TOS through fresh eyes, right? You see that perspective. You call out the things that you see, you know, hey, this really wasn't very good. This movie really looked cool. This looked pretty, you know, pretty cheap. How do you pull all this stuff together, right? There's a lot of truth in that, and also trying to marry what we know about Star Trek's future with you know, how the heck do we even get there? So it's pretty cool. Yeah. All right. So I guess what I will say is to our listeners out there, what say you when you think about this subject? If you're a Planet of the Apes fan, and if you're not, first of all, I highly recommend you see it. And I guess the latest three movies are also quite the trilogy, and I think for all to be enjoyed. I'm a bigger fan of the old school. It's just me, I guess. But at any rate, I hope that that you watch the movie if you haven't seen it in a while. Think about it and kind of compare and contrast what the three of us came up with this evening. So
yes, I would vouch for the movie. Go see it if you haven't, and rewatch it if you have. It's good.
It is good. It's good. Okay. So what I'm going to do now is just say, hey, big thank you to our associate producers. We have Renee Roberts. We have Norman Lau. We have Aaron Harvey. We have some guy named Nick Anastasio, Tim Robertson, Richard Marquez, and Corey Elrod. Guys and lady, thank you. Thank you so much, because your willingness to contribute to our show in the network in general allows us to keep continuing with all these podcasts. And I am telling you, right, we can see, the three of us see this going on in the network right now. There are more shows than you can shake a stick at out there right now. There's like five or six versions of Discovery podcasts flying. So there's a lot of good things happening. And all of it takes quite a bit of money to put together, to buy the equipment, to do all those things. So if you would like to be an associate producer on our show, hey, we'd love to have more, or any of our shows, or would like to contribute in any amount, we would appreciate it. We would ask you to go to Patreon, that's patreon.com/trekfm, and donate whatever dollar amount you can afford. Just know it's $25 a month to be an associate producer, and it's $15 a month to be a part of the Trek FM roundtable, which we've all hosted and been on at different times. So good stuff there. So as we finish up, I'll turn to you, Nick, first. Where can we find you on the internet, sir?
The Babel Conference will probably be the easiest place. I'm on Facebook. I'm one of those weirdos who's not on Twitter, but you can find me on Facebook under my name, and at the Babel Conference, where I'm always trolling around. Well, actually, no, I try not to troll. I loiter.
Okay. And Amy, I know you have to open up the notes that are about the size of an encyclopedia to go through all the things that you're doing and where people can find you. So we're going to sit back and listen. Where can they find you? Maybe it's easier if you tell them where you can't be found.
The queen of podcasts.
You guys are too funny. So you can find me here on the network. What are you talking about? I co-host with Richard Marquez and Justin Ozer, Earl Grey, which is the podcast about the next generation, my favorite. And you can find me on The Edge, which is the new podcast for the Discovery. And I co-host with Brandon J. Mutella, Michael Schindler, and Aaron Harvey. And I do a little mini show called Postcards from the Edge, where I talk about and read the fan response of the episode. So that's where you can find me on the network. And I am on Twitter at Miss Amy Nelson. So you can tweet me there. And my favorite place is on the Babel Conference. So that's where you can find me there.
Pretty
That's
good.
Not too many shows, right?
No, it isn't. But you know, I give you a lot of credit. You've been working very, very hard to bring a lot of shows to the network, all up to date. And hey, Discovery's the end thing, so it's rocking it out. And it's nice to see you be a big part of it. And I hope you're having fun with it, because it seems like you're getting
very much so. I love the interaction with the fans. Like Postcards is becoming one of my favorite shows.
Yeah, anything. Yeah.
And you're getting more comments on Postcards every week. I'm looking at the number of comments, and they're increasing every week.
I know, and I'm so excited. And you know, there's been 2 weeks of Discovery, and it's fun to hear, oh, I heard my name on the air, and that's really great. I try and read as many as I can, but there are so many. But
you're gonna have to start doing a speed reading like the guys at the auctions to get out, get on.
Well, I did coach debate, and so maybe I could pick up some of those skills there.
There you go.
Yeah, maybe. Well, maybe it's no longer postcards. It's long letters from the edge. I don't know. Yeah. That's all. Yeah. Anyway, I'll enjoy it. So that's good for you. For me, you can find me also in the Babel Conference doing as much commentary as I can for the shows that we drop here for Standard Orbit. And I also like to play around and listen to as many podcasts as I can on the network. There's so many. Boy, we're so spoiled. We try to keep up that way. You can find me on Twitter at BostonSCPO and at Facebook as well. So we're out there. So I appreciate all of you listening, and we will see you next week for another edition with Zach Moore of Standard Orbit.